Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Do some of you remember from childhood hearing and maybe even reciting those words from the Hebrew Bible? Jerusalem and Jericho are two of the oldest cities on earth. They're just 10 miles apart as the crow flies. Jerusalem is high on a mountain ridge. Jericho is in the Dead Sea Rift Valley. The ancient caravan route connecting these cities winds through a treacherous canyon that was called the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Traveling along this route was dangerous even in broad daylight. Sudden rainstorms could trigger flash floods cascading down the canyon with no warning. Bandits lurked inside canyons and in underground caves, awaiting opportunities to ambush and assault. The Galilean rabbi who told the parable of the Good Samaritan and those who heard his story had made the journey through the Valley of the Shadow of Death, and they knew its dangers. Perhaps they knew someone who had been robbed and left for dead. The parable was told in response to the question, "Who exactly is my neighbor?" The law says that we are to care for our neighbors just as ourselves. The problem is there are gazillions of needs. How am I to choose? How do you define neighbor? The questioner wanted a precise definition because he didn't want to waste his time being compassionate to those whose social status or place of residence or pre-existing conditions may have placed them outside his particular circumference of neighborliness. Who is my neighbor? Define your terms. The rabbi responded, as he most often did, not directly, but by saying, "That reminds me of a story." A story with some unexpected twists. There was a man going from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell in the hands of robbers. They stripped him, beat him up, and left him half dead. A priest was going down that road, and when the priest caught sight of him, he went out of his way to avoid him. When a Levite came to the place, he took one look at the man and crossed the road to avoid him. But this Samaritan who was traveling came to where the man was and was moved at the sight of him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring olive oil and wine on them. He hoisted him onto his own animal, brought him to an inn, and looked after him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins, which he gave to the innkeeper, and said, "Look after the man, and on my way back, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you've had." The story ends there, abruptly. No happy ending. It ends in the middle. Today, we consider the challenge of caring. At one level, the caring instinct is built in, but compassion is loaded with lots of shoulds and oughts. And so today I want to do a couple of things. I want to unpack this Good Samaritan story just a little bit, and then I want to offer a couple of suggestions that I have found helpful as signposts amidst the very difficult landscapes of showing compassion and caregiving. Let's return to the reading out on the open road in the Valley of the Shadow of Death. There was a man going down the road. Who was he? We don't know. We don't know his age, if he has a family, how he makes a living, where his home is, what sort of life he may have led up to that point. Nothing. All we know is he's out on the road. Without warning, he is assaulted, robbed, and left for dead. Who did the dirty deed? We're not told. Was it one of the nomadic tribes of Bedouins who live nearby, even today, who pitch their tents along the narrow canyons of the Judean desert? Was the assailant someone who knew the traveler and perhaps held a grudge? We don't know. The man is assaulted, stripped, and beaten. The bandit makes off with their loot, leaving the man half dead. That's it. no identifying labels. This story directly confronts cruelty and evil completely devoid of any cultural, social, psychological, or moral factors that might be relevant to the brutal violence. Along come two travelers. In Luke's editorial spin, he names one as a priest, the second as a Levite. Both are very important people in Jerusalem. Each of them is an expert on the many laws of purity and proper behavior toward God and toward humanity. And each of them, seeing the body of the beaten man, takes the long way around so that they won't notice. We don't know anything more. Maybe the priest has an important weekend workshop or a bar mitzvah to get to. Maybe the Levite is fearing for his own safety, lest he be assaulted if he stops. We don't know. But they're both going out of their way to avoid getting involved. Then the Samaritan, the most deeply despised person for hundreds of miles. They were the hillbillies, the rednecks, the yahoos, scorned by the Judeans who held the power and privilege at the temple in Jerusalem because the Samaritans living far from Jerusalem had to improvise their own form of worship, and so they were scorned. Fights over worship go way back. So what do we know about this particular Samaritan? Nothing. Does he have a family, a vocation, a destination? Such details don't matter because it is this moment that matters. What does the Samaritan do? He is moved by compassion and stops. But there is no mention of God's laws or duty or any standards of proper ethical behavior. What matters is not laws, but events in this moment. The Samaritan stops. And in doing so, he puts himself at great risk. He's in enemy territory. So he's vulnerable not only to ambush, but to passing Judeans. But he gives first aid to the beaten man, using every item at his disposal. He puts the beaten man on his own animal. They journey to an inn. He remains there overnight. And he instructs the innkeeper to continue to care for the man, promising to return and pay whatever else might be owed. The Samaritan resumes his journey. The story ends. It ends in the middle. No happy ending. We're not told if the beaten man ever recovered. Maybe he died the next day. We also don't know if the innkeeper might have pocketed the money and not cared for the man. We also are not told how the Samaritan's life was changed, if at all. We don't know whether or not he ever returned as he had promised. There is no moralizing and no tidying up of this brutal event. You can imagine the silence among the listeners. Not only the legalists, but also Yeshua's closest followers. Well, is that all? What happened? What's your point? So here's our question for today. Why didn't the storyteller explain how showing compassion had an outcome that made a difference? I mean, what an opportunity for a moral lesson. But that doesn't happen. Because compassion is not a means toward achieving success or any outcome at all. It is not a fix for a problem. Compassion is like gratitude. It is a movement of the human heart. It is not a means toward a worthy end. It is a radical decision of the human heart, period. I want to offer just a couple of perspectives that have served me well as I seek to offer kindness and compassion along the open road. I have found, first of all, that those experiencing trauma and loss are in a different landscape. Some may respond publicly, others just need to be left alone. Some may seem strangely unemotional in public and in private. We can't presume that a person is not hurting just because we don't see it. Grieving folks also experience time quite differently. Normally for us, time moves in kind of familiar rhythms of days and weeks and months and so forth. But for those who are grieving, time does some really strange things. It can grind to a halt, holding the pain in a kind of slow motion. And they may wonder, my gosh, when will my grief ever end? And then, perhaps without any advance warning, time lurches ahead. They're caught off guard, unprepared, to face another birthday, another anniversary, another milestone. And they wonder, where did my time go? Time plays other tricks to those in the midst of loss. The boundary between present and past keeps shifting. Those who are grieving may forget that a death has occurred and expect to hear a voice calling to them. And then the past fades away, and they're back in the present, maybe with even greater sorrow, because time has cheated them once again. Because of these distortions of time, you and I must encourage those dealing with loss to live by their own timepieces, even with all the deceptions. They need to trust their inner calendars and rhythms, even if it brings winter in the midst of summer. I've also learned that in offering compassion, rituals create dignity that words do not. One example, this is from my colleague Forrester Church. In the Israel National Museum in Jerusalem, there's a display case with a collection of tiny cups about the size of a thimble. These tiny ceramic versions of egg cups were sacramental vessels. People cried their tears into these cups and held them on their cheeks to retain those tears. One cup for tears of joy and one cup for tears of grief. And what do you do in a time of joy or grief? You go to your mantle, you pick up one of your tear cups, you put it under your eye and you cry into it. And when you're done crying, you cap it and then put it back on the mantle. It is a way to save your tears. How wonderful it must have been for someone who just could not go on anymore. She picked up her cup of tears and cried until finally her cup ran over. And this is what it means in the 23rd Psalm when it says, "My cup runneth over." When we give ourselves away and risk greatly love and care to the point of greatest vulnerability, when we pour ourselves out, not only do we fill up one another's cup, but our own twin cups of joy and sorrow, they surely overflow. Compassion, friends, is a great risk. It's a great risk. To laugh is to risk. To risk appearing a fool. To weep is to risk appearing sentimental. To reach out is to risk involvement. To expose feelings is to risk exposing your true self. To love is to risk not being loved in return. To hope is to risk despair. To care for another is to risk failure. Didn't get what I wanted. But risk must be taken, because the greatest hazard is to risk nothing. Those who risk nothing may avoid sorrow, but they cannot learn or grow. Only a person who risks is free.